Public Radio.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm tonight's host, Ethan Elkind. What would it mean for the Bay Area if sea levels were to rise not 3 feet by 2100, as most estimates suggest, but instead by 5 or 6 feet? Recent studies indicate we might be in for this kind of dramatic increase. According to a paper published online in Nature last week, if greenhouse gas emissions continue to grow, a massive Antarctic ice sheet may begin to melt, causing a much more rapid and substantial rise in sea levels than previously anticipated. This comes on the heels of another report warning that current levels of greenhouse gas emissions could result in superstorms, disintegration of large parts of the polar ice sheets, and a rise of the ocean big enough to cause flooding of the world's coastal cities by the end of this century. How is our city by the bay and the surrounding area equipped to deal with these alarming predictions? Would popular destinations like the Ferry Building and essential infrastructure like the airport and Transbay Transit Center be flooded? What sort of protections are developers of new projects expected to put into place to protect our residents from the ravages of rising seas? Is there anything we in the Bay Area can do to prevent this fate? Joining me in the studio tonight to discuss these issues and more are Letitia Grenier, co-director of the Resilient Landscapes Program at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, a nonprofit organization specializing in aquatics and ecosystem support. Letitia was lead scientist for the 2015 State of the Estuary Report and the 2015 update to the Baylands Ecosystem Habitat Goals, heading a team of over 200 environmental scientists, managers, and regulators to develop science-based recommendations for restoring and maintaining the health of the Bay's tidal wetlands in the face of rising sea levels and other stressors. Welcome, Letitia.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined tonight by Will Travis, a consultant, writer, teacher, and speaker on sea level rise adaptation planning. From 1995 until the end of 2011, Will was executive director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, BCDC, the nation's first state coastal management agency. Under his leadership, BCDC became the nation's first state coastal management agency to adopt development regulations for addressing sea level rise. In 2012, he served as a senior advisor to the Bay Area Joint Policy Committee, which coordinates the land use planning of 4 regional agencies. Welcome, Will.
Thanks for having me here.
And finally, on the phone, we have Gil Kelly, Director of Citywide Planning with the San Francisco Planning Department and co-chair of San Francisco's Sea Level Rise Coordinating Committee, an interagency task force of 12 city departments tasked to develop a comprehensive understanding of the threat of sea level rise and to create a decisive plan of action. As Director of Citywide Planning in San Francisco, Mr. Kelly oversees 5 functional teams: General Plan and Citywide Policy, Community Planning, Plan Implementation, Information and Analysis, and City Design. He previously served as Director of Planning for the City of Portland and Director of Planning and Development for the City of Berkeley. Welcome, Gil.
Thanks very much for having me. Good evening.
And finally, we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. We will start taking your calls in about 20 minutes, or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So now on to our guests. Well, when you think about sea level rise, we think about a lot of scientific projections. So, Will, I wanted to start with you. What are the projections for sea level rise over the next decade and looking out towards the end of the century to 2100?
Well, Ethan, I'm going to share a secret with you. I don't want you to tell anyone, though. The way to make a lot of money is to get a bunch of experts on sea level rise into a room and ask each of them to predict exactly how high the sea will be at any particular date in the future, and then bet against all of them, because at best you're going to lose one of those bets. The problem is we don't know. The science is imprecise. We've never had the opportunity to model what we're doing to planet Earth right now. So the challenge for us in planning is to plan in such a way that we're making prudent decisions, and if the sea level rises slower than we thought it might, that's okay. We haven't wasted a lot of money. And if it rises faster than we thought it might, that's okay too, because we have adaptation strategies in place.
And Letitia, speaking from the sort of wetlands ecosystem perspective, what do you see as likely projections and impacts going out towards 2100?
Well, as you said in the intro, previously there was a report that California agencies had to follow that predicted a midpoint of a 3-foot sea level rise. But that same report actually had about 5.5 feet as the higher end. And so a lot of agencies have been shooting toward that to be conservative, to make sure that we are protecting our resources and our shoreline. And so I think that that new Nature paper that you mentioned is going to help us realize that the uncertainty that Will's talking about is something we have to include in our planning. And one of the ways that I think about it is, if you build things, if you plan on a higher sea level rise or faster sea level rise, then when there's a storm or when there's an El Nino year, you're going to get those higher sea levels anyway for a shorter amount of time. So that investment that you've made is actually still protecting the coast during that time.
And Gil Kelly, can you speak to us in terms of what San Francisco is anticipating with these sea level rise impacts, and maybe particularly what types of infrastructure do you think is most at risk in San Francisco?
Sure. Well, we've been somewhat conservative, meaning that I think we're planning for not the base case of the projections that we're all hearing about, but an upper reasonable range of those. And what that translates into for the San Francisco Bay is about 66 inches by the end of the century, so about 5.5 feet, whereas much of the sort of best guess predictions have been around 3 feet so far. And so we have understood that the science is evolving, and it will continue to evolve. And as Will Travis alluded to, we're part of our methodology is to just keep revisiting the science as the modeling gets more precise, and predictive. So that's sort of baked into our methodology going forward. The other piece of that, of course, is to make sure that whatever solutions we arrive at, whether those are through regulation of private property or through public infrastructure or through some set of partnerships investing in longer-term solutions, that those solutions are adaptable, meaning that they are capable of being raised up or being further augmented as sea level rise advances. It's not going to stop rising by the end of the century, so whatever we do needs to be adaptable in the future. The other large piece, I would say, is that it's important for cities and regions and states to keep their eyes on the other half of this dynamic we're in, which is the mitigation side, meaning how do we continue to aggressively try to lower greenhouse gas emissions, which is causing this problem in the first place. So if we don't pay equal attention to that, we're certainly going to be in worse hurt as the decades advance. And so I think for cities particularly, there are these twin activities to focus on, which is how do we adapt to rising tides, and then how do we also continue to do the things on the energy side, for example, that will lower our overall emissions. So they're both important. Mm-hmm. That being said, we have studied the potential risks at a first pass level in San Francisco, and by rough calculation find that, and this is a conservative estimate, meaning kind of low, I think, that about $75 billion worth of assets, both public and private, including the airport, are vulnerable. That is to say, they are in zones that would be inundated by those end-of-century projections. And that $75 billion simply represents replacement value in today's dollars. It doesn't account for loss of business or for higher costs that might be incurred by doing further sea level rise mitigation, for example. That's just kind of the sort of dead value of those assets right now. So we know we have a big problem. And I would say that there are some things that are pretty observable. The Embarcadero is in this last December, when the combination of the El Nino and the King tide arrived, the bay level was only I think less than a foot below the Embarcadero level. So, you know, it's something that can't be pushed off forever. Similarly, where the Muni line enters under, to go under Market Street, enters on the Embarcadero, is clearly an opening that could be vulnerable there, which means larger parts of that system could be at risk, because if the trains can't get through there, they back up and you shut down whole parts of the system. And they're probably less, much less visible parts of the infrastructure. If the sewage treatment outfalls are not sufficiently raised and adapted, then if those back up, then people living at very high elevations won't be able to flush their toilets, for example. So it's a very kind of a pervasive situation, and we have to do put on our best creative thinking to really make the adaptation that's needed for these things. And that's why we have recently produced an action plan on behalf of the mayor to raise the level of attention about this. It's not to scare people, because we do have some time to do these, but it's going to create a very deliberate thought process and an engagement of the public to arrive at solutions that are acceptable. We certainly don't want to just wall around the city waterfront with a, you know, 9 or 10 foot tall concrete wall. The waterfront is critical to our identity and a place people love to spend time. And so whatever we do going forward has to be well-designed and well-thought-out.
Mm-hmm. So lots of good information there about what the city is looking at in terms of risks and ways to try to combat it. Will Travis, I want to go back to you, since you looked at this from a sort of Bay Area-wide perspective. What do you see as the most vulnerable parts of the Bay? What types of infrastructure, what types of places do you think are most at risk with sea level rise?
Well, the Bay Area is particularly vulnerable to sea level rise because of what we did in the past. The bay that we see and love today is about a third smaller than it was at the time of the gold rush, because the bay was quite shallow. Two-thirds of it was less than 12 feet deep. So vast parts of the bay were reclaimed for real estate development. There's about 240 square miles of low-lying land around the bay that was filled, but it was filled just high enough to get it above sea level of the past. So that filling of the bay in the past is a great predictor of what sea level rise can do to the bay in the future. And if you just get a map of the filled areas, it's downtown San Francisco, the Financial District, Mission Bay, San Francisco International Airport, Oakland International Airport, parts of Richmond, vast areas. Silicon Valley faces double jeopardy, because Silicon Valley used to be called the Valley of Heart's Delight, and it was fruit orchards that were irrigated with well water. And as the water was extracted, the ground elevations sank. So much of the South Bay shoreline is below current sea level. Well, you think about that and say, well, if it's below sea level, why doesn't it flood? It's separated from the open bay by a mosaic of ponds that were used for salt production. But the levees between the ponds weren't designed or engineered to provide flood protection. In fact, Steve Ritchie of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, who is an engineer, looked at him. He said, Trav, those are not levees. Those are heaps of dirt. So we could have a situation where on any dry, sunny day, we could have flooding of Silicon Valley if an earthquake melted those heaps of dirt into pools of mud. So those factors together make the Bay Area particularly vulnerable to sea level rise and flooding in the future and now.
So lots of things to worry about from a human perspective. Letitia, I want to ask you about the ecosystem perspective. What do you see as most at risk from an ecosystem wetlands perspective with this sea level rise?
One thing that a lot of people may not know about San Francisco Bay, it was actually had a vast amount of wetlands in the bay around 1850, when Will was talking about, before it started to be filled. And these wetlands are called tidal marshes. You can see them when you fly out of the airports. You look down and sometimes you see those curvy little rivers at the edge of the bay. And that's actually one of the most valuable ecosystems on Earth. The only ecosystem that's been valued higher than tidal marsh is coral reefs. And the reason it's so valuable is that they protect the shoreline. They actually knock down waves. So if you've got a large tidal marsh in front of a shoreline, you don't need to build as big of an engineered levee to protect whatever you may have behind there, which could be the freeway that you take to work, your sewage treatment plant. We have a lot of landfill, or it could be Google or Facebook back there. They also help clean the water, and they provide habitat for wildlife. And in the Bay Area, we actually have a hot spot of biodiversity in our tidal marshes, so we have lots of endangered species there. So from the ecosystem side, we have already lost about, well, originally we lost almost 90% of our marshes. We've been trying to gain them back. But with the threat of sea level rise, they could actually go underwater. And so we, as a group of scientists, have come together to try to figure out what are the solutions that we can think of to keep our tidal marshes around longer so that we can keep getting the services from them that we like, so we can keep having big wetlands in front of our shoreline instead of big walls.
Mm-hmm. And with all these basically very alarming types of impacts that we could be seeing coming in the future, you mentioned one potential nice outcome, or better than bad outcome, instead of these seawalls having these wetlands. What should be our response? And Gil Kelly, I want to go back to you with the city of San Francisco to hear more about what San Francisco is doing in response to this threat. Can you describe some of these efforts that are underway?
Yeah. First of all, we have gathered all the city agencies together as part of a coordinating committee on sea level rise, and have asked them to do a couple of things. One is to look carefully at their asset base, that is to say, all the infrastructure that each of those departments oversees and controls and budgets for, and really investigate in terms of which of those assets are vulnerable to sea level rise, that is to say, they're in the mapped inundation, potential inundation zones. And then secondly, to do some kind of assessment of the risk, that is to say, if it floods, how important is that? Is it a long-term investment that has decades still to go? Is it something you were about to replace anyway? Is it something that maybe is okay to flood? Maybe there's a tip of a park that floods and becomes a wetland, and that's okay, for example. On the other hand, if it's the Muni Tunnel going under to Market Street, that's not okay. So we're asking them to do sort of infrastructure piece by infrastructure piece, a real hardcore assessment, so that we can, within a couple years' time, produce a very detailed adaptation plan. The second thing that we've decided upon is to really partner up with both regional agencies, in fact, using the San Francisco Estuary Institute's science, as well as other jurisdictions, and we've had very successful initial conversations with other cities and with BCDC about launching kind of a international design challenge. It's a little bit distinct from a typical design competition where many teams of architects sort of go after the design of one building hoping to get the prize, and instead modeling it on what was done on the East Coast in the New York region post Hurricane Sandy, in a process called Rebuild by Design, where essentially we've gathered really smart and knowledgeable people on this topic from around the world, and grouped them into 10 teams, each looking at different representative landscapes around the bay and a representative of a diversity of communities around the bay, and really engaging directly with those communities to come up with long-term designs and solutions. And so those teams will be composed not only of landscape architects and engineers and urban planners, but also people who are fiscal experts, that is to say, how might we finance some of these solutions, as well as community engagement specialists and a whole range of expertise on each of these teams. So we're hoping to launch that process in the fall of this year. It would take the better part of a year to complete, but we think that will give us at least the beginning of a handbook for how to proceed on some of these longer-term big solutions. We know we can, in the meantime, kind of put in some regulations in our building codes and planning codes that would make sure that each new building is elevated to the point it needs to be, but the water will find its way in between buildings. So we need some larger solutions here, that keep the bayfront ecology intact or even enhance it, that keep there's a wonderful recreation space, but also make sure that it protects the city from eventual sea level rise.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to City's Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we are discussing how the Bay Area is responding to the threat of rising seas with Letitia Grenier, co-director of the Resilient Landscapes Program at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, Will Travis, a consultant, writer, teacher, and speaker on sea level rise adaptation planning, and former executive director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, BCDC. And joining us on the phone, we have Gil Kelly, director of citywide planning with the San Francisco Planning Department and co-chair of San Francisco's Sea Level Rise Coordinating Committee. We also invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Are you concerned about rising sea levels? Do you have questions about the wetlands and how their restoration can help to prevent flooding? Are you concerned that your home or favorite haunt will be flooded in the event of superstorms and high seas? The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on KALW.org or tweet us at CityVisionsKALW. Will Travis, I wanted to ask you a similar question to what I asked Gil Kelly instead on a Bay perspective as opposed to what the city of San Francisco is doing. What do you think the response should be, and what is the response now from a sort of Bay-wide perspective to sea level rise?
Well, I want to build on what Gil was talking about, because the city, through its initiative, is bringing us a regional perspective. The effort in New York and New Jersey was called Rebuild by Design, because that's what they were doing. We're calling, or Gil and the folks out here are calling, the effort Resilience by Design, designing resilience into structures, into ecosystems, into landscapes. But the problem is, when you say that, what does that mean? What does resilience look like? I mentioned to my daughter that this effort was underway, and she was skeptical. She said, "What are you talking about, Dad? Are they going to have rubber buildings?" I said, "No, no, no, that's not it." But what I think will come out of this design competition, Resilience by Design, will be concrete, not in the form of concrete, but realistic proposals that people can look at and say, "Ah, now I understand what you're talking about. Now I see how we can change the way we plan and design and build along the waterfront so that it is resilient, not just to sea level rise and storm surge, but to earthquakes and to a variety of other challenges we will face, and also addresses one of the problems that we have in this very rich region, is that we have very vulnerable populations living along portions of our shoreline around the bay. And there is an issue of environmental justice that we need to incorporate into this regional effort. So with the efforts that San Francisco has initiated now in partnership with other local governments, and as Gil mentioned, with state and regional and federal agencies, with the San Francisco Estuary Institute, we're beginning to have a more systematic regional approach. BCDC has had a program underway for some years now called Adapting to Rising Tides, the ART process, where they will work with a series of local governments and stakeholders to look at where the areas are vulnerable and look at different concepts and different adaptation strategies for dealing with that. So we have a variety of things underway here in the region. We are recognizing what is a fundamental political truth of California, and that is home rule. So it might seem easy to say, well, the state should come in and pay for a vulnerability analysis and do it for the whole region and then tell local governments what to do. But mitigation, that is reducing greenhouse gases, is one of those things that really only works best if it's done globally. Adaptation is done foot by foot, yard by yard, property by property, local government by local government. It has to be implemented locally, and in order to do so, it has to be politically realistic.
We have an email comment or question in from Phil, who says that the only real solution is to protect the whole Bay Area by building an eco barrier under the Golden Gate, which would be an engineering challenge, as he acknowledges, but he says just the melting of Greenland alone is a 25-foot sea level rise. So, Letitia, I want to ask you what you think, whether it's an eco barrier or something else, what do you think that the Bay Area should be doing right now that it's currently not to be better prepared for this coming sea level rise?
Well, we're not at the 25-foot sea level rise scenario yet. So I think what we should do for now is plan for the projections that we have in the next 50 to 70 years. And for that, our wetlands are actually an extremely resilient option. So I think it was great that we brought up the term resilience, because if you look at the way our natural systems work, when we don't interrupt their processes, they can actually grow and protect us against sea level rise for hundreds of years if there's enough sediment and if there's enough space for them to be. So when you have a wetland with plants in it, a tidal marsh, it can actually grow vertically. It can actually accrete sediment and keep rising with sea level as long as it has enough sediment, or it can actually move up onto the land and continue to protect our communities that way. So we have a lot of options that where we can use natural processes and get a lot more benefits. It'll probably be less expensive than jumping right to hard engineering solutions that tend to be only a single benefit and have to keep being updated and re-engineered over time. So they're highly costly and they don't give us much in return. On the issue of barriers in particular, it does seem like that would be maybe a safer option. But what we've seen is that when you dampen that tidal energy coming into the bay, you stop all the biological processes that are happening in the bay and many of the physical ones too. So it could have huge implications for the food web. But more importantly, we would actually begin to lose those marshes that are protecting our shoreline right now. What happens is on the very highest tides, that tidal energy pushes sediment and water up onto the marshes, and that's what helps them keep building vertically. If you stop those tides, if you dampen them with the barrier, then your marshes are not going to be able to keep up. You've interrupted the natural process that made that resilience. And then you would actually lose a lot of protection that we already have. In addition, we'd be losing the other functions of marshes that we already have, such as they're actually assimilating some waste for us from our sewage treatment plants. They're protecting endangered species. So things that we've been taking for granted since Europeans got here would start to go away, and I think we'd have unintended consequences.
So in other words, with more wetlands, we don't need rubber buildings. I guess that would be the take-home point there. So I want to go now to Bob from Oakland, who's on the line. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, thank you. A very simple question. Why are we continuing to develop Treasure Island?
So that sounds like a question for Gil Kelly with the City of San Francisco. Gil, do you want to answer that one?
Yeah, one of the things that has occurred over the last few years in the Treasure Island planning is actually an awareness of potential sea level rise. And so part of the plans there have been to accommodate that by raising portions of the land that would be developed on, and also by creating a sort of earthen landscaped berm around the perimeter of it so that it's actually protected. That's also one of those solutions that I was mentioning at the beginning of the show that's potentially adaptable. So as sea level rise increases or rises further than our predictions potentially, that berm essentially can be increased in height. So, you know, I think it's fair to say that that thinking has been kind of baked into their plans. Whether it ultimately works in the way it's designed will have to be discovered once it's all sort of tested out and as the years go by to evaluate that.
So, Will Travis, I'd love to hear your take on development projects going forward in the Bay Area and what you think should be put in place to take into account sea level rise.
Well, looking at Treasure Island, it does seem that might be a foolish thing to do. But the planning solution that they came up with and the design solution for Treasure Island is very elegant. Essentially, there's only three things wrong with Treasure Island. One, it's low-lying, so it's vulnerable to flooding. Two, the only way you can get to it is on the Bay Bridge, and having come over that this evening, I can tell you that's never a good option. And three, because it was made of dredge material put behind levees, it, in an earthquake, it's about as stable as soup. So other than that, it's a fine place. And what the planners have come up with is a design solution that raises the ground elevation of the part that they want to develop so that it's above the projected sea level. Secondly, they use a process called densification, which hammers the sand together to the point that it's like concrete. So they solve their seismic problem. It turns out that it's very expensive to do that. So they do it in as small an area as possible, which means that everybody who lives there will be within walking distance of a ferry, so they don't have to use the Bay Bridge. Then they reserve the entire shoreline of the island for a levee, which if they need in the future, they can put there. It's a big, wide park that will become a big, wide park on top of a levee. And they put a something called a geological hazard abatement district in place, so the people who live there and the businesses there pay for it, so we, the general taxpayers, don't. So it ends up being a very elegant, internationally recognized design solution to something that you look at and at first blush doesn't seem to be a good idea, but it does demonstrate that if you carefully think through the options and the ways of dealing with them, there are planning approaches to deal with even these areas.
So you're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we are discussing how the Bay Area is responding to the threat of rising seas. Joining us in studio are Letitia Grenier, co-director of the Resilient Landscapes Program at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, and Will Travis, a consultant, writer, teacher, and speaker on sea level rise adaptation planning and former executive director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, BCDC. And joining us by phone, we have Gil Kelly, Director of Citywide Planning with the San Francisco Planning Department and co-chair of San Francisco's Sea Level Rise Coordinating Committee. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Are you concerned about rising sea levels? Do you have questions about wetlands and how they can help prevent flooding through their restoration? Or are you concerned that your home or favorite haunt might be flooded in the event of superstorms and high seas? The number to call to join in this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on kalw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Letitia Grenier, I wanted to go back to you with that question, not just about Treasure Island, but I think about all the projects that are sort of in the pipeline, perhaps most prominently the Golden State Warriors in the midst of a potentially record-breaking season. And they're thinking about a brand-new arena right there, seems to me, at a place that could be very vulnerable to sea level rise. So what is your take on these development projects? Should we not be allowing them to go forward? What should be done to address the likely impacts of sea level rise on all these proposed projects?
Well, I think in the places like Treasure Island and where the Warriors Arena would be, you know, that is a tough one for the city planners to work on. What I do see, though, is that we've got ourselves into this situation in great part by filling the wetlands that were here naturally. And there are wetlands that are actually still proposed for development. So I think the most simple common denominator, kind of no-brainer, is let's not build on areas that are still open space wetlands. And if you can believe it, that's still happening. And these are all low-lying areas, highly prone to flooding, that would then have to be protected. The alternative, instead of developing those areas, would be to restore them to wetlands and provide more protection for the areas behind them. Another point I wanted to make about that is it's not just development of large infrastructure like we're talking about, but even the choices that communities make to protect their immediate shoreline is going to be really important to what happens to their neighbors. So some of the recent science is showing that if I put a seawall around my community, the waves that come and hit my seawall will then be higher and it will be more erosive and are actually going to erode your shoreline across the way more so than if I built a soft shoreline or I restored a wetland around my community. So we're getting to this place where kind of the project by project, everything done separately isn't going to work as well. And we actually need to take a community approach to thinking about how are we going to do our shoreline as a region so that that we don't get to a tragedy of the commons place where the wealthier communities that can get permitted to have higher seawalls sooner are creating problems for other communities that may not get permits done in time and then experience more erosion in their areas.
And we have an email question from Patricia who asks how the public can get involved. And Gil Kelly, I wanted to throw that question to you since you work for the city. What's the best way for the city to be involved in this issue and try to help with the process of trying to adapt to sea level rise?
Yeah, a couple of things they can do right now. And then, as I mentioned before, we're going to be launching a very public design challenge process beginning this fall. But they certainly can get in contact with us at the planning department. Our website has information there, and we have staff working on this very issue now. So that's one way to get engaged. There's also this high-level action plan that we just produced for the mayor's office that kind of lays out the issues and the bigger challenges going forward. So that would be another piece to at least come up to speed on. We hope to really engage the public in a very deliberate way on the ground going forward through this design challenge, including some of the bigger infrastructure pieces that Letitia referred to, but also some of the smaller fixes and choices, options for the local shoreline in various communities up and down. I would just remark that to the previous question that the conditions at the Embarcadero or at Mission Bay where the Warriors Arena is proposed is one set of conditions, and actually those projects like the Warriors Arena have gone through their environmental review process using these higher sea level rise numbers. So they've done a good job of sort of protecting that building. Where we need some thought is really along the length of the shoreline, and much of the new development going south from Mission Bay along the so-called Southern Bayfront and all the way down to Hunter's Point and Candlestick, India Basin, and so forth, each of those larger sites that have potential development are already setting back substantially from the shoreline and going through a process of design that actually softens, to use Letitia's word, the shoreline that they do have there already, which isn't always soft in many cases, and employing some of these wetland restoration techniques as part of that. And I think that wetland restoration is actually an important strategy going forward, because to the extent that we actually create some sort of horizontal levees in the water, that's a great protection for the wave action that can amplify the rising tides and increasing storms. And so using nature, as Letitia mentioned, to kind of take the edge off some of the worst effects here, just outside of the pure rise in height of the sea, can be a very important tool in the toolkit, so to speak.
And Will Travis, in terms of the bureaucratic response to this, what do you think might be some of the new processes or zoning or design standards, planning, building codes, et cetera, that you think we need to start thinking about now, about putting into place to try to deal with where we're going to be growing and knowing that the environment around us is changing at the same time?
That's a very good question. And the fundamental problem that we face is that for the past 8,000 years or so, since when I was actually quite young, our climate has been stable. And so without any great amount of ice melting or water freezing, sea level didn't go up or down. And as a result of that, the shoreline didn't move. 8,000 years. As a civilized species, we've only been around for about 6,000 years. Mesopotamia, Egypt, that was when I was a little boy. As a result, we as a civilized species think of the shoreline as never moving. So we have put into place all sorts of rules, laws, regulations, and property standards based on what we've learned, which is that the shoreline is where the shoreline always was, and that's where it will always be. And now it's going to start to move inland and upland for as long into the future as we can imagine. So we have a series of policies and rules that may make it illegal to do the kind of resilient development we want to, because it is either in the water now, where we have a series of rules to prohibit filling San Francisco Bay, or will become in the water in the future. So I think what we're going to have to do is take examples, take efforts like the Resilience by Design Challenge, figure out how we build and want to build along our shoreline, and then we're going to have to go back and reverse engineer all the laws to allow us to do what makes sense.
Sounds like not an easy thing to do, but I actually would think that in some ways changing the laws might be harder than changing the infrastructure in some cases, knowing how entrenched some of these codes are. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing how the Bay Area is responding to the threat of rising seas with Letitia Grenier, co-director of the Resilient Landscapes Program at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, Will Travis, consultant, writer, teacher, and speaker on sea level rise adaptation planning and former executive director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and Gil Kelly, director of citywide planning with the San Francisco Planning Department. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. You can call us now at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on kalw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Letitia Grenier, let me go back to you with a somewhat similar question. So perhaps in addition to planning processes and zoning codes, are there specific physical requirements you think that we should be asking of projects that are on the current shoreline?
Yeah, I think that's right. And we have an idea about how to try to organize this a little bit, because San Francisco Bay is actually highly complex. So there's parts of the bay where it does make sense to restore a large tidal marsh, and there's parts of the bay where it doesn't. There's parts of the bay where you could put oyster reefs perhaps instead. Maybe that's the right place for a sandy beach. And there's really a lot of science, both physics, biology, and even chemistry behind how to pick those areas. So our idea of how to do that is to actually come up with some categorization of the shoreline to identify appropriate types of actions you can take. And then that's what all the many agencies that do have jurisdiction over permitting each project could look at as they start to think about what they want to let pass through. And that's also part of the idea in the Resilience by Design competition, is that science would be involved from our institute to provide some guidance to the kinds of designs that we'd like to see in the areas that are part of the design challenge.
And I'd like to go to the phones. We have George from San Francisco. George, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Along the lines of what we were just saying, how many miles? We're taking inventory of the shoreline of the bay. How many miles around the entire bay that we could consider to be subject for planning, for construction, or for marshlands, et cetera? And the second part of the question is, can we point to any other areas, any aquatic environments on the planet where similar planning has been done, or anything that's a significant fraction of the mileage that we have here to deal with? Do we have any partners in this project that might be working on it parallel at the same time on the planet now?
So Will Travis is former head of San Francisco's BCDC. Do you have thoughts in response to that question?
Well, one of the challenges we faced at BCDC when we started to look at this issue is we looked around the country and around the world, and we found that they were all looking at us. We are pretty far ahead. One of the places we did go and drew a lot of inspiration and ideas from were the Dutch, because they've been holding back the sea for 800 years. But we found that even the Dutch are embracing the notion of living with water. They realize you can't hold it back anymore. You have to incorporate it into your planning and your design work. As to the amount of shoreline, this is one of those trick questions. What's the shoreline of San Francisco Bay? If you drive around it, it's about 400 miles. If you paddle along the shoreline, it's about 300 miles. And if you go in and out of every little slough and inlet, it's about 1,000 miles. So it depends on how you approach your design, whether you're dealing with it at a gross level or a micro level. As to how much of that is suitable for wetland restoration, the San Francisco Bay is the most urbanized estuary in the United States of America. It is also home to the largest coastal wetland restoration project outside of the Everglades. So we are dealing with both a very urbanized estuary, but we are also committed to an approach that recognizes that the best engineering is usually the least engineering, the engineering where you look to what nature wants to have happen, and nature always gets to bat last, so we want to get on nature's team.
Great. Well, thank you, George, for the question. We have a bunch of email questions that have come in, which I want to direct to Gil Kelly at the City of San Francisco, asking about specific projects and how they may be influenced by sea level rise and what the city might be doing to address that. So Patricia asks about the Great Highway in particular and the sewage treatment plant there. Denise asks about Mission Rock and whether or not sea level rise was taken into account with that project. And finally, Rosemary from Berkeley asks about the Cargill project on the salt ponds, which, Gil, I believe is outside of your jurisdiction. But if you had any thoughts on that, we'd love to hear them.
Well, I'll defer on the last project. But on the others, you know, San Francisco has a very diverse shoreline, so I'm glad someone brought up the Ocean Beach, because really the ocean, the western side of the city, the sort of northern arc of the Presidio properties, and then the whole eastern side of the city are very distinct geographies. With regard to the Great Highway and the sewage treatment plant, those are clearly in our thoughts, and the PUC is actively planning for sea level rise with regard to the sewage treatment plant outfalls there, and that's an expensive undertaking, and that's something that's already in the works. There was a community engaged sort of a master planning process, if you will, for the Ocean Beach area, which included actually retreating and moving a portion of the Great Highway and removing it from the direct shoreline. That's one area that we're already seeing is begin to wash away. Some of the parking areas there have already begun to slip just with increasing storm activity. So fortunately, on the west side, even in the end of century numbers, housing is not affected directly, so it's mostly how we manipulate the nearer shore areas, including the Great Highway. And so that will be part, at least subject to a potential design competition realm that will focus more closely on those conditions. But as I said there, I think there was a very nice community-engaged plan that was done a couple of years ago, led by Spur, to really get at some of these issues on the west side. With regard to the Mission Bay projects, each of those has been required to go through a so-called CEQA analysis. Their environmental review is part of their planning and approvals by the city. And so the specific facilities and sites have proposed solutions there that we think are adequate for the protection of their particular properties or buildings. What's missing, as I mentioned before, is really what is a sort of area-wide protection for that part of the shoreline. And that's why we're doing this larger design challenge to really come up with those pieces. The Candlestick Point and Hunter's Point Shipyard areas that have already gotten their approvals similarly went through an analysis that considered sea level rise, and they have adaptation plans already in place there. So it's going to be sort of knitting together all the potential future development as well as some of these broader shoreline long design options that, again, go to trying to solve for all three things: for sea level rise protection, for public access to the shoreline, and for enhanced ecological values.
And just a reminder that you can join the conversation with your questions by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Letitia, I wanted to ask you about the economic costs of all of this adaptation. What is this going to cost to put all these pieces into place to deal with sea level rise, and where are we going to find the money to do it?
That's a great question. Save the Bay estimated that it would cost about $1.5 billion to do all the tidal marsh restoration where the lands have already been purchased, but the restoration projects haven't gone forward. And while that may seem like quite a bit of money, it's actually a lot less than the estimates we have of what it would cost even if there were one really big storm that hit the Bay Area and caused damage from water. And I think that $75 billion in vulnerable assets gives you a good idea of what could be at stake in the long term. So even though the price tag seems high, it's probably a really good investment that's going to save us money. By spending a little bit now, we'll save a lot of money later. The other piece of that is that there is a ballot measure coming up on the June ballot in which Bay Area citizens can decide if they want to spend $12 per parcel per year, and that money would provide $500 million over the course of 20 years. So that would be a huge jumpstart into making this wetland restoration happen a lot quicker. And the reason that it needs to happen quickly is that we really need to get our marshes in place, and we really need to get them fed with enough sediment soon before the sea level rise curve starts really accelerating. And that's part of what that paper in Nature that you mentioned was about, which is how fast is sea level rise going to get going by the end of the century? Right now it's rising, but it's going kind of slowly. But at some point shortly after 2050, 2060, 2070, somewhere in there, sea level rise is going to start happening so quickly. It's like nothing we've ever seen as a civilized species, as Will was saying. And I think that's really going to open our eyes to what the new world will be like. And so we really need to be ready very quickly. We need to restore our marshes very soon to be ready for that.
And Will Travis, do you have thoughts about the economic costs and what our response should be to help support these changes?
Well, one of the wonderful things about living here in the Bay Area, and you can tell this by the questions tonight, we don't have to defend the science. And the other thing we don't have to do is make the choice between dealing with climate change and growing our economy. All of these efforts that we've been talking about are all being run in complete partnership with the business community in the Bay Area, because the business community realizes the Bay Area is in competition with the rest of the world to attract investment capital here. And with so much low-lying land vulnerable to flooding, climate change and sea level rise is not an environmental problem here. It's an economic imperative. The business community has realized they can make a lot of money by coming up with innovative ways to reduce greenhouse gases, and they have also realized that it's in their own best interest to deal with this problem. And that is why in this bond measure, the leading proponents of passing it are the business community in the Bay Area.
And sorry, Letitia Grenier, did you have a comment?
We should just say what it's Measure AA on the ballot so that you recognize it when you go to vote.
Yes, very, very important to mention that. So Gil Kelly wanted to ask you, from the city's perspective, do you feel like you have the financing base that you need to make these changes? And you know, you also mentioned when you first spoke about the need to also mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. Is there financing and enough sort of tools that the city has to take on both of these tasks of adapting to the future climate impacts, but also helping to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that are causing these rising seas?
Well, on the question of financing sea level rise solutions, I would just say that, as Letitia mentioned, it's probably in the billions, but that's over many decades. And I think what we're trying to do now is to position ourselves to grow the funding for that, both locally and with the state and federal agencies, and even with, as Will mentioned, private participation over time. What's hard to estimate now is that we don't know exactly what those solutions are. I think the wetlands measure that was referred to will be a big help, a good start. There will ultimately be more things that the city of San Francisco and the other cities around the Bay will have to do. But I do think that having us unite as a Bay Area and come together around potentially really compelling and win-win designs puts us in the best possible place to get both public and private funding from a whole number of sources going forward. So I think that what we're planning to do is in parallel with the design process of coming up with these good ideas, also really examine different funding alternatives and all the potential pots, current and future potential pots of money. So I would say that's part of our investigation going forward. With regard to the mitigation side of lowering greenhouse gas emissions, there could be some overlap between the two in terms of investments made, but I would say that many of the city and regional agencies are already keenly aware of the need to invest more in transportation, alternative transportation means, which is probably one of the most powerful things we can do as a region to lower greenhouse gas emissions ultimately. That's also big ticket expenditures, but over decades coming forward. So we're not going to do one and not the other. We have to do both. But we're a growing region with a very healthy economy, and potentially in the future with greater access to congressional largesse. So I think if we can get everyone to sort of be on the same page in terms of where we want to go as a community and set of communities around the Bay, the better position we're in to get that funding over time.
We've got just a few minutes left. I'd love to get about 30 seconds of closing thoughts from each of you. So, Will Travis, final thoughts for the audience. And I guess one other quick follow-up, if you might mention it, is are there any good models that the Bay Area can look to that are doing this really well? But closing thoughts as well. Will.
Well, unfortunately, as I said, the Bay Area seems to be the model for everybody else. We are looking at the model that came out of the New York, New Jersey region with the design competition. Gil mentioned transportation. If you think about the Bay, it is largely ringed by transportation facilities, railroads, freeways, airports, ports. They are particularly vulnerable to flooding. So how we retrofit them and how we design them so that they are safe from sea level rise provides us with an opportunity to use that retrofit process to provide protection for the areas inland. So I think we should look to the transportation planning process as a great place to start this.
And Letitia Grenier, closing thoughts?
I would just encourage the citizens of the Bay Area to get involved in those kinds of retrofit processes that Will was talking about. It's really our choice. Do we want to have a bay that's surrounded by wetlands, full of wildlife, clean water? Or are we going to be living with a bay where we constantly have to keep building up higher walls around the edges? And I think, you know, there's a way that if we all get involved, we can end up with the optimal solution.
And Gil Kelly, real quick.
Yeah, I'm very much speaking for the city of San Francisco. Really look forward to really creating a more robust set of regional partnerships with other cities around the bay, with regional agencies, and frankly with communities of residents and businesses around the bay to kind of tackle this problem together. That's the whole thesis behind this design challenge, is to integrate science and good design thinking with really local energy, local knowledge, to come up with some really inspired ideas about how we actually use this kind of long emergency of sea level rise and turn that into a kind of wonderful shoreline that can be in place for centuries.
Great, thank you. Well, that's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Letitia Grenier, the Resilient Landscapes Program at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, Will Travis, former Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and Gil Kelly from the City of San Francisco's Planning Department. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. Join Joseph Pache next Monday for a discussion of the tensions on UC campuses between academic freedom and the university's anti-discrimination policies. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.